So before we start, let me remind you once again that tomorrow the meeting for the excursion is at 11:20 in front of the hotel, okay? And the next speaker is Chris Pope, who'll tell us about Kerr de Sitter black holes in higher dimensions, please.
So this work I'll talk about is work I did recently. Well, actually, there are really two parts to it. The main part of the talk would be work I did recently, a couple of months ago, with Gary Gibbons, Hong Liu, and Don Page, where we looked at the problem, which surprisingly had not been tackled until recently, or perhaps surprisingly, of looking for the general rotating black hole solutions in higher dimension when you have a cosmological constant. So that's the first part, the main part of the talk. And then in the final part of the talk, I'll describe some work I've been doing very recently with Miriam Svetic and Hong Liu, where we've been looking at the situation of rotating black holes, again with a cosmological constant, in the case where you have electric charge as well. And we have some partial results that I'll be describing. So that really is the structure of the two things that will be in this talk. So in four dimensions, of course, this problem of rotating black holes was much studied a long time ago. And the rotating black hole Kerr solution was obtained in the 60s, and then it was generalized to the case with a cosmological constant. If you go to dimension D, then instead of having just a single rotation parameter, you now have multiple rotation parameters once you're in higher than four dimensions, because you can have rotation in orthogonal sets of two planes. And so once you are in five dimensions, for example, you have now two independent rotation parameters in the general solution in two orthogonal two planes. And in general, if you're in D dimensions, you will have the integer part of D minus 1 over 2 of these orthogonal D planes, orthogonal two planes, and thus D minus 1 over 2 integer part of independent rotation parameters in the general solution. Now, in the case R mu nu equals 0, these general solutions were obtained by Myers and Perry in 1986. And then if you ask about the case with a cosmological constant, then in the case of five dimensions, which is the one of principal interest from the point of view of the ADS-CFT correspondence, Hawking, Hunter, and Taylor-Robinson posed the question and answered it in their paper in the late 90s as to what is the general Kerr de Sitter solution in five dimensions with the two independent rotation parameters of the general case. They also found some restricted results in higher dimension in a construction which actually is very analogous to one Gary Gibbons referred to at the end of his talk this morning. A way where you could essentially take the four-dimensional Kerr solution and then add in extra dimensions to construct a solution which is, in fact, a Kerr de Sitter solution of the higher dimension with just a single rotation parameter, just the one that is in four dimensions kind of carries on up to the higher dimension, but you don't get any more in that construction. So that was the state of the art until we did our construction this year of what was already known. Now, it's fairly tricky to start from first principles and simply by imposing the symmetry conditions that you expect for the type of solution you're after, of simply writing down the most general metric ansatz and getting the equations and trying to solve them. It's already quite tricky in four dimensions and in five, let alone when you go to higher or indeed arbitrary dimension. And so it seemed to us that that was not the way to proceed in order to try to construct these arbitrary dimension rotating Kerr de Sitter black holes. So What we did instead was to get as much of a guide as we could from the known cases. So the Myers and Perry results in the absence of cosmological constant, and then the known Kerr de Sitter results in four dimensions and five dimensions specifically, we used those heavily as a guide to try to make a conjecture for what the metric should be like in the higher dimension, and then it comes down to just a matter of, in principle, of cranking a handle to test whether the conjecture was good or bad. Now, that still is quite a tricky thing to do, because the metrics are quite complicated, and directly to calculate the Ricci tensor is quite an involved business. But there's a feature that was already known in four dimensions for the Kerr de Sitter black holes, amongst other four-dimensional metrics, and also it held also for the five-dimensional Hawking, Hunter, Taylor, Robinson black holes, and that is that they could be put into what is called the Kerr-Schilt form. And if you can put a metric into a Kerr-Schilt form, then you're in much better shape from the point of view of actually doing calculation to calculate the curvature, to calculate in particular the Ricci tensor. And so it's a useful way, if you can do it, of being able to check whether what you've got satisfies the Einstein equation or not. So since the Kerr-Schilt form may not be familiar to everyone, I'll say a little bit about this. A metric of Kerr-Schilt form will be a metric, I'll call it G hat, mu nu, which can be viewed as the sum of a kind of base metric or fiducial metric, G mu nu, plus an H mu nu, where that H mu nu is some function times K mu K mu, where K mu is a null vector, which is geodesic, with respect to the fiducial metric, G mu nu. So the hope is that you can write your metric, which may itself be quite complicated, as the sum of something relatively simple and under control, G mu nu, plus this H mu nu constructed from the product of null geodesic vector, K mu nu, K mu nu, K mu, K nu. Now, obviously, if you have a metric like that, then if you take the inverse metric, you will find that as an exact statement, the inverse is given by G mu nu upper minus H mu nu upper, where you raise and lower indices on H using the background fiducial metric. That's obviously true because of the fact that K mu is zero, because K is null. And so if you think about the higher order terms that you normally would get in an expansion of the inverse metric, it'll be H contracted into another H, but every time H contracts into an H, you'll get zero because of that null property. So clearly the inverse of the metric is just given by its linear approximation, if you like. There is no plus dot 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 in that. What is less obvious, but remarkably is true, is that if you calculate the Ricci tensor for the hatted metric, for the full metric, then it also is given exactly by its linearized approximation, so to speak. The linear approximation is exact. If you think of the normal calculation of the Ricci tensor for G mu nu plus H mu nu, then as a linearized result, you will have that the Ricci tensor of the full metric is that of the base plus something which is really the Lichnerowitz operator acting on H mu nu. Well, I think it's perhaps it's not a totally well-defined question, because you'd have to say what you're prepared to accept as the fiducial metric, the base. I've wondered about this point. I mean, is it meaningful even to ask which metrics can, which metrics can't? Because it depends, you know, in the extreme case, you could say that everything is its own Kerr-Schilt metric, where you write it as itself plus nothing. That's trivial. But, I mean, to what extent can you... it may depend to a large extent upon what you're prepared to tolerate as the fiducial metric. So I don't know whether there's a well-defined answer to that.
In the Kerr case, the fiducial metric is just flat space.
Oh, yes, right.
So in that case...
Yeah, I think as soon as you say you want to write something as flat space plus more, then presumably you're into a restricted class, but I don't know what is known in general about that. Okay, so we have this lucky fact with the Kerr-Schultz form of a metric that the Ricci tensor for the Hattie, the full metric, is given by the exactly by the linear approximation, so to speak. By the way, it's important that the indices are one up and one down in that expression there. Obviously, because the inverse metric is linear in HBU, then it's obvious that the Ricci tensor will be given by something of finite polynomial degree in HBU. But the fact that it turns out to be purely the linear terms that survive in that one up, one down form of the metric of the Ricci tensor there is a rather remarkable but true fact. Okay, so that means that this could provide us with a way of calculating the Ricci tensor for the full metric if we've written it in Kerr-Schultz form. And so we proceeded on in the hope that we would be able to do that. Now, let me just show with the most trivial example of all of writing a well-known metric in Kerr-Schultz form, because it illustrates some of the points that are analogous to what one does in more complicated cases. So let's take the Schwarzschild metric in four dimensions. So here it is, with f, the usual 1 minus 2m over r metric function there. Now, you can reorganize that just by kind of, not exactly completing a square, but just group those first two terms together as a dt minus f to the minus 1 dr times a dt plus f to the minus 1 dr, with a minus f around the front, obviously that's the same as up above. And now, if you define a new coordinate in place of t to be the integral of that first term there, and that is integrable because f depends only upon r, so you can integrate that up to, in principle, to get it, well, easily enough to give you u in terms of t and the integral of f minus 1 dr, then the metric takes the form given here. And then, if you wish, and this point is not essential, but just to make things look familiar, if you now define a new time coordinate again, t tilde, I think that is, which is u plus r, which is essentially like undoing what's been done here, but it's undoing it at zero mass, whereas this redefinition here was done with mass m, and we've pulled out the m-dependent factor. There you see. So if you now undo it and go back to a t tilde, then the metric is written here, and you can recognize the first part as just being Minkowski space-time, plus 2m over r times this thing, and you easily see that that's a null vector. And you can easily check, furthermore, that it's geodesic. So here we have this function, 2m over r is like that function little f in what I had before, and dt tilde minus dr is the one form k mu dx mu in this simple example. Now, one of the reasons I went through this is to just make the point that it was nice to do this final redefinition here to put the fiducial metric into a manifest, obvious Minkowski form. I mean, it's almost obvious here, but in this case it's so trivial that there's not so much difference. But the step of rewriting the fiducial metric as a canonical way of writing flat space in this case was inessential. And that's a rather key point when you come to look at a more complicated example. So now let's move on to what we did to get the Kerr de Sitter metrics. Well, the key thing to do, and we were guided heavily by what was done by Myers and Perry in their paper in the case with no cosmological constant. Turns out the natural thing to do in their case is to write the fiducial metric, which would be flat for them. Not in terms of ordinary coordinates, spherical coordinates, but a kind of spheroidal coordinates. Turns out that what one should do here is to write the de Sitter metric, which is going to be our fiducial metric, in a non-standard kind of spheroidal system of coordinates. And so let me explain what that is. There's always in this game an issue of even dimension versus odd dimension. There's no great difference in complexity between the two, but you just need a slightly different description in the two cases, depending upon whether the total dimension is even or odd. And it's slightly easier, perhaps, to describe the odd-dimensional case. So I will focus on the odd-dimension case, and I'll indicate later small changes that you make if you want to do the even-dimensional case. Okay, so we start by writing the de Sitter metric, which will be our background or fiducial metric in a canonical kind of way. So time, a radial coordinate called y, and then a 2n minus 1 sphere metric here. And that clearly is just a rather canonical way of writing the de Sitter metric with cosmological constant. I'll call lambda the cosmological constant. The normalization here is the Ricci tensor is d minus 1 times lambda times g mu nu. It saves carrying some dimension-dependent factors around to do it like that. So there's the de Sitter metric. And next we write the 2n minus 1 sphere metric in this form here. So what's done here is to introduce a set of direction cosines or latitude coordinates called mu I hat. And that's a set of n coordinates subject to the constraint that the sum of their squares is equal to 1. And then we have a set of n azimuthal coordinates, phi I. And the metric on the sphere can be written like that. And if you check in low-dimensional examples, you can solve this constraint on the mu hats by writing, for example, mu 1 hat equals cos theta and mu 2 hat equals sine theta if you were doing three dimensions for the three sphere, and you'll see easily enough that that is a way of writing the metric on the unit sphere. Yes? It's really to do with this, yeah, because if you're doing an even, if you want the sphere here to be even dimensional, then you have to have one extra mu hat coordinate that doesn't have an associated azimuthal angle. And that odd one out amongst the mu hat coordinates actually has a different coordinate range. These ones all range between 0 and 1, but the odd one out, the extra one, would range between minus 1 and plus 1 if you were doing the even dimensional case. Okay, so that's the way that we will write the sphere metric here. And then we change to these spheroidal coordinates, which means changing from using the mu hats subject to that constraint together with the radial coordinate y, we change to a new radial coordinate r and a new set of mu i's without hats, which again are subject to the constraint that the sum of their squares is equal to 1, with this being the relation between the original and the new coordinates. Now, this is obviously just a coordinate transformation, and so what we get after applying that transformation and plugging into the de Sitter metric up there, it'll still be de Sitter space, but just written in a slightly different way. And in fact, it ends up looking like that. Now, you might ask, well, what's the advantage of doing that? We took something simple, and we've turned it into something pretty complicated looking. Well, the advantage is that it turns out that now, to take this de Sitter metric and turn it into a Kerr de Sitter is very, very simple. So all we do is we do the Kerr-Schild construction. We write the ds hat squared, which is going to be our Kerr de Sitter metric, as the de Sitter metric sitting here as the fiducial one. And we add on a function 2m over u, where u is a certain function, times k mu dx mu all squared. That's just writing the same thing as g hat mu nu is g mu nu plus 2m over u times k mu k nu. And this k mu dx mu, which is written as a one form, is this null one form, which is geodesic, takes the form written down here. So I'm not explaining where we got this exactly. I mean, it really didn't take too much. There weren't too many possible things to try by the time we'd got it to this form. But, I mean, really, the whole strategy here was to try to guess what the answer should be, and then hoping that by using these spheroidal coordinates that we would be directed rather naturally towards that guess. And, indeed, that turned out to be the case. So that's what turns out to be the answer. De Sitter plus this piece here where k mu dx mu is given. And the function u is given here. So remember we got r and mu I, and phi I and t as our coordinates in the metric. Well, now comes the question of is the guess correct or not? And the advantage of the Kerr-Schild form is that it's relatively simple to do the calculation. And so we did tests, and of course it's convenient to use the computer to do such calculations. So using Mathematica, we were able to check that our conjecture metrics do indeed solve the Einstein equation in all dimensions less than or equal to 11. Nothing particularly special about 11, except that that's where patience ran out for running the computer program. It gets progressively, of course, lengthier and lengthier to do the calculation as an explicit calculation as you add more and more dimensions, because the summations are running over larger and larger ranges. So within the limits of patience, 11 was more or less the natural limit, and it seemed a nice number to stop at anyway. So we explicitly verify for dimension less than or equal to 11 that these metrics that appeared on the previous slide do indeed satisfy the Einstein equation. And this was done by using that nice Kerr-Schild formula that the Ricci tensor is given by its own linearized approximation. So I say I've presented the metrics for the odd dimensions. The case of even dimensions is very analogous with the differences I was mentioning just now. So very, very similar formulae hold in the even dimensions too. Now, in order to study the global structure of these metrics, it's helpful to change from the Kerr-Schild kind of formulation to a more canonical type of Boyer-Lindquist system of coordinates, and after some relatively simple coordinate transformations, one can do that, and the metrics take this form here. I should say, of course, that necessarily these things all reduce to the previously known cases. If you turn off the cosmological constant, it reduces to Myers and Perry. If you specialize to five dimensions or four dimensions, it reduces to previously known results.
Mm. Just trying to understand the geometry of this Kerr-Schild business, I guess it ends up providing you with a map from the usual geometry to the new one. So what does that map look like? I mean, what is it mapped to the entire space, including inside of the event horizon, or just the exterior? And what gets mapped to the event horizon? Is there any picture?
Let me see. The Kerr-Schild coordinates, I'm going to say it either the right way around or the wrong way around. The Kerr-Schild coordinates
are good inside as well as outside. Gary, are you? Yeah. Am I right? Boyer-Lindquist is not. Have I got it the right way around? Right.
The Kerr-Schild formula really only works in advance and you can think of the
right.
Yeah, we've got the advanced that's it. Yeah. You could, of course, do an equivalent with future rather than past if you wanted.
And furthermore, the Kerr-Schild coordinates match the positive R, and in some space function, you go to negative R, so they also do a good test.
True.
Okay, so. Well, one can then go through
standard calculation. You have horizons where the function, I think I said it wrongly, I meant to say where V equals 2M, I should have said, not where V equals 0, I'm sorry, Yeah, I think it's not instantly obvious in this, but you check, you find that you get the degeneration, you get the null. The degeneration occurs at v equals 2m, so that should have said v of r equals 2m. So that gives you a horizon, and in the standard way, as you analyze the Kerr matrix in four or five dimensions, you then can introduce co-rotating coordinates, so to speak. You can calculate the angular velocities associated with these rotations on the horizon. And the killing vector d by d tau, d tau is the time coordinate, plus omega I d by d phi I. That killing vector becomes null on the horizon. It's what Carter calls a killing horizon at this value r equals rh, where v is equal to 2m. And then you can calculate the surface gravity in the canonical way. And from that, you have the Hawking temperature. Right. Now,
it's well known that in four dimensions, you can take the Kerr metric and you can Euclideanize and pass to a real
Euclidean signature metric by performing a Wick rotation, tau goes to minus I tau, and at the same time, replacing the angular momentum A by I times A. And that gives you a real section, which is of Euclidean signature.
And the same was done in five dimensions. It can be done with the Hawking, Hunter, Taylor-Robinson metrics. Now, Gary was talking this morning about a class of five-dimensional metrics that was constructed by the three Japanese, Yasui et al., which they obtained by following the same procedure that Don Page had used many years ago in four dimensions, where he took the Euclideanized Kerr metric, and he showed that by taking a careful limit and imposing appropriate periodicity conditions, he showed that you could get a metric which extends smoothly onto a compact manifold, which is the S2 bundle over S2, the non-trivial S2 bundle over S2. And Yasui, well, Heshimoto, Sakaguchi, and Yasui this year did the analogous thing with the five-dimensional metrics of Hawking, Hunter, and Taylor-Robinson. They Euclideanized and then looked for conditions under which the metrics could be extended smoothly onto compact smooth manifolds. And they found that they could get these S3 bundles over S2, which were either trivial or non-trivial, according to whether the pair of integers that Gary was referring to this morning, whether the sum of those integers was odd, odd for the non-trivial case or even for the trivial case. Well, now that we have these higher dimensional Kerr de Sitter metrics, we can play the same kind of game in an arbitrary dimension. Now, to achieve these, let me just loosely call them compact metrics, I mean metrics which extend smoothly onto compact manifolds, you will achieve that by ensuring that the radial coordinate runs between two endpoints. And those endpoints will correspond in the Euclidean section to what were called horizons previously. So again, when I speak of zeros of V of R, I've made a mistake. I should have written where V of R equals 2m again. So you arrange for the radial coordinate to run between two values of R, R equals R1 and R equals R2, at each of which V of R minus 2m vanishes. Now, in general, you will have singularities in the metric, and in general, those singularities at these endpoints will not be removable. You'll have some kind of conical singularities. In fact, we've got a lot of endpoints in principle to talk about. We've got the endpoints where these latitude coordinates or direction cosines vanish. But that's just a standard familiar kind of issue of in polar coordinate systems or spherical polar coordinate systems, that where a latitude factor goes to zero, the associated azimuthal coordinate has to have the correct period in order
that the apparent coordinate singularity there is removable by change of coordinate to a local system of Euclidean coordinates. So in the standard way, the removable singularities at mu, because mu I equals zero, they're removable if the azimuthal coordinates each have period 2 pi. The real issue is then concerned with these other endpoints at the endpoints of the range of the radial coordinate R. Well, if you ask what is the structure of the metric near one of those endpoints, then if we introduce a proper distance coordinate rho, so you write the metric near one of those endpoints as turn it into writing it in the vicinity of rho equals naught, where rho is like a proper distance coordinate, then the metric will have this general structure here, d rho squared plus kappa 1 squared rho squared d tor squared plus this other stuff here, where kappa 1 is nothing but surface gravity evaluated at that point, r equals r1, or at the other end at r equals r2. And then these omegas here are just like those angular velocities I defined before, but now in the Euclidean section. Okay, so that's what the metric will be like near one of these radial endpoints. It's convenient to rescale, absorb kappa 1 into the tor coordinate, which is the Euclidean time coordinate, what used to be time but has now been turned into another angular type coordinate. Absorb kappa 1 into that by defining a new coordinate psi 1. Here we go. Psi 1 is kappa 1 times tor. And then you can see clearly that psi 1 there will have to have period 2 pi in order that the singularity at rho equals naught would be removable. So the criterion really is that you should have psi 1 having period 2 pi if you hold the phi I coordinates, the phi 1 I coordinates, the co-rotating azimuthal coordinates fixed. Well, you have that condition at the endpoint r equals r1. You have the same kind of condition at the other endpoint at r equals r2. And now the whole question comes down to one of compatibility between these two coordinate charts. So at one end we define psi 1 and the phi 1 i's, the other end we define psi 2 and the phi 2 i's, and all of these coordinates should have period 2 pi, and you can easily work out the, from their definitions, you can easily work out the relation, the transition matrix that maps you from the coordinates at r equals r1 to the coordinates that are good at r equals r2. And so that matrix there, think of that as a matrix S, is the thing that implements the mapping from the two coordinates, between the two coordinate systems. Now, all those coordinates have period 2 pi, and so that means that it's necessary that the matrix S should have purely integer entries. Of course, it should be invertible, and then its inverse also should have purely integer entries. And so, in other words, S must be an SL n plus 1z matrix, SL n plus 1 matrix with integer entries. And so that gives you a set of conditions, if you look at the form of that matrix, in order that those entries will be integers, and that the inverse matrix should also have purely integer entries. It implies that kappa 1 and kappa 2 should be equal in magnitude. Let's call their moduli kappa 1 equals kappa 2 equals kappa. And the differences between the angular velocities at the two endpoints should be kappa times integers ki. So we have a set of n integers ki characterizing the that matrix. And what you then have, looking back at the structure of the metric near one of those points r equals r1 or r equals r2, what you then have
is you've got a Tn bundle where the coordinates phi I form the circle coordinates of Tn. You have a Tn bundle over S2, the S2 in question being a two-sphere that has, so to speak, a latitude coordinate r running between r1 and r2 and an azimuth coordinate psi.
You have a Tn bundle over that S2 with these n integers, ki, characterizing the winding numbers of the image of the equator of that two-sphere, the winding numbers into Tn.
And then the metrics themselves
that we have are metrics on an associated SD minus 2 bundle over S2. Capital D, remember, is the total dimension. And the structure group is this Tn we're seeing here.
So that Tn acts on the azimuthal coordinates that are used in the construction of the sphere.
Okay, so under these conditions, we then have regular metrics which extend smoothly onto the SD minus 2 bundle over S2.
And rather like the Yasui example in five dimensions, the situation here is that the bundle is trivial or not according to whether the sum of the ki integers is even or odd.
Now, it's a bit of a mess, and I'm not going to present the full mess of how to convert it, but so I'm just kind of leaving it with some rather messy steps unpresented. But if you look at how exactly these, you've got this system of equations you've got to satisfy here. Essentially, you've got at your disposal, if you fix the cosmological constant lambda, you've got at your disposal the mass and these AI rotation parameters. You could choose those such that the conditions here are satisfied. Remember, those angular velocities are expressed in terms of the AI parameters. Well, it turns out that in order to have the two surface gravities at the two endpoints, R1 and R2, equal, you have to do it by having the points, R1 and R2, move together and become equal. Now, that doesn't mean that there's no interval between them, because if you work out the proper distance between R1 and R2, then as you allow R1 and R2 to approach each other, you find the proper distance remains non-zero. And so you have to do an appropriate rescaling of coordinates in order to have a proper distance coordinate that doesn't degenerate. The proper distance doesn't degenerate to zero length in that limit. At the same time, the surface gravity is going to zero, so in this formula that I've written down here, which is what you get from just writing the difference of the angular velocity should be kappa times the integers ki, you get a zero on the top and the bottom, and the zeros cancel out, and you get a nice, sensible, finite, regular limit. So without going through all the further coordinate transformations into the coordinates that then you would want to use, I think the principle should be clear, that this system of conditions here will give you a system of constraints on the rotation parameters ai, such that you're satisfying this set of regularity conditions up above. And then under those circumstances, you then have regular metrics on these SD minus 2 bundles over S2. So that's the generalization of the page metric in four dimensions and the Yasui et al. S3 bundles over S2 in five dimensions. And so that works in arbitrary dimension. All right, so now to conclude, I'll talk about charged Kerr-de-Sitter-metrics. Now, again, in four dimensions, these have been well known for a long time, since the late 60s when Carter constructed the, so to speak, the Kerr-Newman-de-Sitter metric. Now, it's fairly clear in that case what were the equations that you're trying to solve. You want to consider the Einstein-Maxwell equations in four dimensions and then ask for black holes which have electric charge or magnetic charge or even both and rotation. And that's what you're after. Now, if you look in higher dimensions, then there are different questions you could ask, and obviously the answer you get will depend upon what you ask for. Certainly from the point of view of string theory or M theory, what is perhaps much more natural to be thinking about is the situations where you can have BPS-charged black holes. And so what you're really concerned with is not so much just thinking about a pure Einstein-Maxwell system in a higher dimension, but you want to think about the system which is the bosonic sector of the low-energy limit, or the bosonic sector of some supergravity in the higher dimension. And so now things become very dimension-specific as to what kind of theory it is that you want to consider. So we focused our attention on what perhaps is the most interesting case from this point of view, and that's to think about five dimensions. And so really, the theory in five dimensions for which one wants to find charged rotating black hole solutions is not just pure Einstein-Maxwell with a cosmological constant, but it's really the bosonic part of five-dimensional gauge supergravity. And that means that we have an additional Chern-Simons-type term, an F wedge J term as well in the five-dimensional Lagrangian. So from a string viewpoint, that really is the thing that's more interesting to think about. So the bosonic sector, then, if we look at the minimal gauged supergravity, n equals 2 gauged supergravity in five dimensions, the bosonic sector will have the Einstein term, cosmological term, Maxwell kinetic term, and then this FFA term in addition. And so that's really the theory of interest. Now, it's still very complicated indeed to think about constructing charged black holes, rotating black holes of the general type in this theory. As soon as you have the two rotation parameters in there unequal, it becomes really quite a complicated problem. And so we simplified things by considering the case where we take those two rotation parameters and set them equal. That gives you extra symmetries and it makes things easier to work with. Now, I should say that if you are looking in the case where lambda is zero for charged five-dimensional rotating black holes, then actually you can get those solutions without doing any real work. There's a lot of messy computation, but no real difficulty in principle to get them for free simply by doing a trick of dimensional reduction and then rotation. You would start with, if you had zero cosmological constant, you start with a rotating black hole solution with no charge and in an extra circle direction. So from 5 you go to 6 by just taking times S1. Do a Lorentz boost in 6 dimensions, reduce down to 5. You now have picked up a Kaluza-Klein vector, which is effectively carrying electric charge. And then you have to do this within the right theory, which will be actually the n equals 2 supergravity coupled to 2 vector multiplets. Start with the six-dimensional theory that reduces to that. View your original five-dimensional rotating black hole as a solution in 6 dimensions by adding in trivially a circle. Do a Lorentz boost, go down to 5 dimensions, you pick up now a Kaluza-Klein vector, which is carrying electric charge. You've got this five-dimensional theory with those extra vector multiplets is the so-called STU model. You can do a rotation to transfer that charge from the Kaluza-Klein vector into one of the other vectors in 5 dimensions. Go up to 6 dimensions again, trivially by adding a circle. Do a Lorentz boost again, come down to 5, pick up now a second charge, which again you rotate off the Kaluza-Klein vector using the discrete symmetries of the STU model. Lift up again, do a Lorentz boost, come down once more, and you've built for yourself like that a 3-charge rotating black hole in 5 dimensions. And now if you choose those 3 charges to be equal, then
you'll end up with a solution where the dilaton is constant, and you can truncate it out of the theory, and you've actually got for yourself a solution of this theory in the absence of cosmological constant describing charged rotating black hole of five dimensions. Now, that whole game you can't play anymore if the cosmological constant is present, because you no longer have the necessary symmetries of the STU model. So there is no kind of sausage machine prescription like that that you can follow in order to introduce charge into previously uncharged solutions by making use of these symmetries associated with the dimensional reduction. So you really are a bit floundering around trying to see how to do this. Okay, so for that reason, rather than being able to just crank a handle, we had to essentially to make an ansatz and then fix it up so that it solved the equations. And for that purpose, it was much easier to think about the case where the two rotation parameters were set equal. So the guides in this case are, first of all, if we turn off the charge, we should get back to the solution of Hawking, Hunter, and Taylor-Robinson with their two rotation parameters set equal. And then another guide is that if we turn off the cosmological constant, we should get back to results obtained by Svetich and Hume and others in the past for the rotating charged black holes without cosmological constant, which were obtained by the kind of methods I was just referring to using the symmetries of the STU model. So we have those as two major guides to what the metric should be looking like. And so with that, and then making ansatza and then cranking the handle of calculating the curvature again, it's helpful to use Mathematica, of course, calculated curvature, and then fixing up coefficients in the ansatz, we arrived at a result. And so this is the result that we obtained for the five-dimensional rotating Kerr de Sitter charged black hole metric. So this solves the equations with the FFA term, Einstein-Maxwell with the FFA term and the cosmological constant. So here's the metric, and here's the potential. And various functions and constants appearing up above are defined here below.
What is the difference
Sorry, what's the difference? Yeah, well, there was no charge before. Yeah, it's the charge that's a new feature. New feature here.
Now, if you can see in all this mess, there are four constants, besides
the cosmological constant, which we think of as fixed,
there are four constants lurking around here. M,
which we can think of as mass.
Q, which we think of as charge. Here it appears in the prefactor of the vector potential. And then there's a rotation parameter, J, and you see it here as the prefactor of the cross terms between time and the angular coordinates defined in psi. And then there's a fourth constant as well called beta. And that one is less clear what the physical interpretation for that parameter is.
It should be remarked that if you turn off the cosmological constant, so that should be taking us to a specialization of Hawking, Hunter, Taylor, Robinson, where you set the rotation parameters of their solution equal.
If you turn off the cosmological constant...
I'm sorry, I said that wrong. If you turn off the charge, we should get back to Hawking, Hunter, Taylor, Robinson with their angular momenta
set equal. And we do, provided that in addition we set the parameter beta to a particular value, beta equals 1. If the cosmological constant is 0, the parameter beta is a trivial parameter. It can be absorbed by rescalings.
If the cosmological constant is non-zero, then it appears to be a non-trivial parameter,
which, as I say, has a not very obvious physical interpretation. And even in the case where you turn off the charge, so you'd expect to get back to Hawking, Hunter, Taylor, Robinson, beta is still there as a non-trivial extra parameter. So quite what to make of it, even in that uncharged case, we're not quite clear. But it seems that it is there. There's a simpler way to present the metrics, which is just essentially to use plus minus combinations of the phi and the psi coordinates here, the angular azimuthal coordinates. And in terms of those, you then can naturally define a set of left invariant one forms, sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3, on the group manifold SU2. And so sigma 3 would be a d psi tilde plus cos theta tilde d phi tilde, where the psi tilde and phi tilde were plus and minus a half the psi and the phi of the previous transparency. And sigma 1 squared plus sigma 2 squared would be d theta tilde squared plus sine squared theta tilde d phi tilde squared. So that's an easier, rather briefer way of writing the metric with functions defined as below. Now, we can talk about special cases here. And there are kind of extremal cases you can think about where the charge Q is plus or minus the mass. And within the class of solution we obtained here lie all of the previously known examples that have equal angular momenta. And that includes a case obtained recently by Gutowski and Real, who obtained a BPS five-dimensional charged black hole, rotating black hole solution, which corresponds, in terms of our metrics here, to taking Q equals plus M and specializing the angular momentum and the constant beta to be given a specific quantities in terms of the mass M. So their solution is our one non-trivial parameter, which we can think of as M. You hold lambda fixed, set the scale, you've got just M left. You've got three conditions imposed on the original four parameters. So that would give Gutowski and Real. There's another earlier BPS solution that was found by Clem and Sabra. And that, in terms of these general solutions here, corresponds instead to taking Q as minus M. And their specific solution is Q is minus M, and additionally choose the parameter beta to be zero. So they had a two-parameter family of BPS solutions. Well, we can be more general here, and in fact, all of the cases where you set Q equals minus M for any choice of the non-trivial extra parameter beta, they are all BPS. So those can be viewed as generalizations of the Clem and Sabra solutions. And then again, if you take Q equals plus M, as well as the Gutowski-Real case here, where three conditions in total were imposed, if you impose just two, namely Q equals M, and just impose a relation between beta and j, which is implied by this, beta times j, well, beta squared times j squared is minus lambda. If you just, or minus 1 over lambda. If you just impose that one extra relation as well as Q equals M, then again, you have supersymmetric solutions. The significance of imposing that second condition on the product of beta and j is that actually, if I go back to here, it means that this constant, 1 plus lambda beta squared j squared that appeared in the metrics is zero in that case. Okay, so the bottom line from that is that there are more general BPS solutions. There's ones of Clem-Sabra type, but with an extra parameter by allowing beta to be arbitrary, and there are ones of Gutowski-Real type, but with an extra parameter over and above what they had. Now, the metric here has event horizons where the function w, which is a function of the radial coordinate, it was the rather disgusting function that appeared in the previous transparency here. The metric has horizons where w vanishes. There's also this function b squared here, which although written as b squared is not necessarily positive, but b squared must be positive if you're not to have closed time-like curves associated with the psi tilde direction of the angular variables of the SU2 appearing in the left invariant one forms. So if you want the metrics to be regular in the sense of having no naked singularities and also in having no naked closed time-like curves sitting outside the horizon, then you need to ensure a couple of things. Let's take lambda to be negative, so it's ADS type in order to be simplified discussion here. You want it to be the case that as R comes in from infinity, you hit a horizon before B squared has had a chance to go negative in order that you not have closed time-like curves. And then you want that horizon to be occurring at a positive value of R before you hit the curvature singularity, which resides at R equals naught. And so you have these conditions that you have to fiddle around with to see when do you get everything as you would really like it. Well, the Clem-Sabra solution, which was found a few years ago, BPS, Q is minus M, and then beta, as we're calling it, being zero, that was known to have closed time-like curves. The more general BPS solutions of that Q equals minus M type that we now have, they, although you can relax the beta equals zero condition to get more general BPS solutions, they again have closed time-like curves. And then the other branch of BPS solutions, where Q instead is plus M, we again had the possibility of a further parameter. Well, we have a further parameter in supersymmetric solutions of that type. But it turns out that the extra freedom that the further parameter provides unfortunately doesn't broaden the set of regular rotating BPS black hole metrics. The Gutovsky real solution had the feature of having no closed time-like curves, but it was just a marginal case. It was only just marginally not having closed time-like curves. They were just barely, not quite, you know, hovering, being clothed by the horizon. As soon as you fiddle the extra parameter away from the Gutovsky real value, then you find that you get back closed time-like curves. So as far as the BPS solutions are concerned, we're not seeing anything new that's regular in the sense of being free of closed time-like curves and no naked singularities. The general solution that we got, and the real interest from our point of view is not so much the BPS limits, but it's really to have for the first time these non-BPS solutions from which one can obtain the BPS cases as special limits. The general solutions that we have, you can find regimes for the choice of all four of the parameters for which you have regular black hole solutions with no naked singularities and no closed time-like curves. So that's really all I want to say about this, that this is just some new work we've just completed, obtaining these general charge solutions, general with the restriction that the two rotation parameters are equal. And we were slightly surprised to find this extra parameter beta. It's not quite clear what its role in life is, but that's part of what we get for free, so to speak. But now we have a uniform set of non-extremal solutions that encompass everything else that was known with equal rotation parameters. All right, well, I'll stop there. That's described really the two things I wanted to talk about, the arbitrary dimension uncharged Kerr-de-Sitter black holes, the general case, and then these charged five-dimensional examples. Well, thank you.
Questions?
I want wanted just to ask if you have checked the external curvature at horizon. We've been talking about surface gravity, about the angular velocities. Is the external curvature vanishing?
Is the what?
External curvature at the horizon, like it is by usual they call. The curve. Is the horizon, let's say, locally flat? Or?
Oh, I see. The horizon, the spheres, but I mean, it's just very like. Right. I see what you're saying. I think it's just the same. It all the same properties that were seen in the four-dimensional case. I think. So yeah, I think it'll be kind of minimal.
Any more questions?
Mm-hmm. If one compares the solution, of five-dimensional theory with the transinus term, with the corresponding solution without transinus term,
Well, it's a good question because we don't know what the solution would be without the Chern-Simons term, actually.
So the statement is that the solution without Chern-Simons term is not known with two.
Right. It's not known. Yeah. It's an interesting question. You know, what would it look like? At first sight, you might think, well, surely it would be easier to solve it without. Than with, but at least within the class of what we were trying to think about, we began to realize it was looking quite tricky to see how one would be able to get solution to the case without the Chern-Simons term.
More questions, anyone? So let's thank the speaker again. And before you leave, Carlos is going to tell us a few things about the festivities tonight.
Okay, so as you know, tonight is this very